Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Wealth. I'm Alex Steger and I'm joined by Ian Wenick. Ian.
Hey, glad to be here. I wish I had a wittier opening, but I can't roast you because you have a seltzer and no afternoon tea.
Oh, this is true. Yeah, I mean, I think we're not even meant to really eat and drink in both the refined environments of our studio. It's also not good for the listener's experience, but sorry, everyone. As well as Ian, we're joined again by Alec Rich. Alec, great to have you back.
Good to be here in this sacred temple of the studio that we have.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, which we treat only with respect. Brilliant. Look, we've got a lot to get through this week, as opposed to, I think, previous weeks where we've either had guests or we've majored on one particular topic. We're kind of going back to our roots a little bit here, and we're going to rattle through two, maybe three stories that we've covered this week, all of them really interesting, kind of all a diverse group, not an awful lot that brings them together. But we're going to start with a story which is what is the online equivalent of hot off the press, you know?
Freshly posted.
That doesn't sound as exciting.
Heating up the servers?
No, we're going to have to
melting the data forms.
Yeah, it's none of those things. It's a great story, Alec, that you've just published, which is all about some senior departures, relatively high turnover within Raymond James's custody division. So there's a few things that we want to pick up on here, but before we do that, I think we have to start at the beginning. Can you just give us a quick recap of what the story is?
Sure, and just to give a little bit of context before I dive into today's story, you know, we reported a couple of weeks ago that Sean Marin, who is a longtime division leader within that RA and Custody Services division in Raymond James, had retired, and then that kind of sparked us getting a tip, which led to a good amount of reporting, and then today's story, which was essentially that over the last 2 years, then there's essentially been a pattern of departures, from this RCS, I'll call it, division in Raymond James, of at least 20 or so folks. And, most recently that's been, kind of headlined by several departures in the last couple of months, including a senior vice president within that division, Brian Layden, and the director of service, David Moss, along with a couple of other senior service advisors. So that's kind of the gist of the story.
And going back quickly to where you started, which I think is a really good point. So we wrote, forgive me, the story we previously wrote, the name of the guy was?
Sean Marin.
Sean Marin. Okay. And effectively, this was one of those cases, which is always quite fun in journalism, where you pick up on something, you cover it, and obviously it's interesting, you have good reasons for covering it. But in doing so, you're effectively pulling a little bit of a thread, and suddenly people are like, oh, hey, well, if you're writing about that, here's a bunch of stuff you should know. And that's, giving too much away. That's effectively what's happened here. A bunch of people said, this guy's by no means the only guy to have left, and there might be a bit more going on.
Right.
So that's fair.
Yeah, no, that definitely was the case. And, I thought it was a bit odd, in that instance, from that initial piece, when I reached out to Raymond James and they didn't comment on, someone's retirement. And, that kind of sparked this further inquiry of, how many of these people have retired, how many of them may have been, cut from the ranks, et cetera. And obviously why the reason that they work out of is, major, kind of source of my inquiries.
Okay. So let's just again, step back for a moment then. So since 23, roughly, this is what sources are saying. So the last couple of years, give or take, how many people do we think might have departed from this division, whether that's voluntarily or perhaps sort of managed out?
Right. So according to my reporting and several sources, it's at least 20 people. Another source with familiar told me that the division itself has, roughly 60 employees. So that's a pretty sizable chunk to be turning over, especially amongst a lot of these leaders who have a ton of institutional knowledge of Raymond James, have been both at Raymond James and in this RCS division specifically for, some of them for decades.
Okay, that's really interesting. And I suppose in terms of trying to understand why, what have you been able to gather? I mean, I think we should probably preface this with, obviously every individual's reasons are their own. We can't necessarily know what's inside everybody's head, but what's your sense been as to what's going on there?
Sure. So I spoke with a number of sources familiar with kind of the division's operations, and they essentially told me that the division-specific work environment kind of contributed to a fair amount of this turnover, and you know, a lot of them did stress to me that this is, they found it to be specific to this RCS division, you know, in terms of Raymond James overall. You know, they said that that wasn't necessarily the case, you know, company-wide, but definitely in this division. And, you know, some of the examples folks gave to me were, you know, lack of general respect shown by leadership and kind of a misalignment with the staff, and, you know, also some instances of managers belittling staff, events like that.
Okay, and we should obviously be fair to all concerned. So this was put to Raymond James, and what did they have to say on that point?
Right, yeah, I mean, a spokesperson for them didn't really go into too much detail in terms of the departures or kind of the pattern that we put to them. But, you know, they did defend the quality of their workplace culture and said that the RCS division continues to grow. But they didn't give us a ton of specifics on that front.
Interesting. Now we've been fair and balanced and discussed the story as well. Just taking a further step back, what's the context? What is this division? Because if... I suppose if one doesn't know more about Ray J, one thinks, well, Raymond James, one of the biggest independent broker-dealers, why does it have a custody and service division? Isn't that something that, you know, has relationships with RIAs?
Yeah, I mean, this is my time to shine, doing this all no notes, which is the reason that a unit like a Raymond James that has a large in-house brokerage business has a custodial platform is because at the end of the day, these types of divisions are all about keeping assets and advisors affiliated with the company in any way, shape, or form. So a good analogy would be Wells Fargo, which had first the Finet Independent Advisor Network, and then it rolled out its own independent RIA custody division. So you'd have advisors, in the Wells Fargo case, that would leave Wells Fargo Advisors, no longer affiliated with Wells Fargo, set up their own RIA, but they'd still use Wells Fargo for custodial services. And so what that means is that Wells Fargo is still able to monetize those assets. So if you're Raymond James, like, yes, they expanded to work with third-party RIAs like a Stewart Partners, which they worked with very closely for a very long time. You keep the assets affiliated, but it's all about you can expand a little bit, but it's about keeping people affiliated and happy, keeping the assets on the platform in any way, shape, or form.
Okay, so you keep the assets on the platform, and you may, in fact, work with them in a more hands-on way as well. You may help them with recruitment or do other services as well.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so you've still got those relationships. So, Alec, back to you then. What is the size and scope of its custody business then?
Right. So, yeah, a number of sources said that the division works with around 300 RIAs, and then another 10 kind of on the clearing side, and also you kind of should establish
and that 10 we would assume is Raymond James, the brokerage business as well, obviously.
Right, absolutely.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
No. And you know, to establish for further context, also the kind of RCS division as we know it today is the product of a 2020 consolidation within Raymond James of its investment advisors division and custody and clearing divisions, and you know, the division is currently overseen by Greg Bruce, who's a Schwab alum and has been with, you know, Raymond James since 2020. Has overseen RCS since 2020.
Got it. Okay. So the clearing and custody division was in 82. Just looking at your story, advisor division was actually launched in 2001. So somewhat kind of early doors.
Yeah. Early adopter.
Compared to others, perhaps. Okay. Really interesting. And so it all sits under one thing. Makes sense you've got a Schwab alum there, because obviously Schwab's done pretty well in terms of running a sort of advisory platform. Really interesting. How does it stack up Ray J's sort of proposition to others of those ones that you've mentioned, Ian? Not the Schwabs and Fidelities of this world, which obviously cater purely to that and don't worry so much about.
So I think a good comparison would probably be Goldman Sachs, actually, which also got into the RIA custody business roughly within a year or two around the same time. And it's worth noting that both those companies, Raymond James and Goldman, made similar types of investments to build up the custody unit, which included, as Al kind of reported, hiring people that had custodial experience from the Schwabs and the Fidelities and the Pershings of the world. So looking to those well-established custodians for a base of talent. And as we've seen here, like, it's tough to keep talent on board when you're not growing into the scale that a Schwab or Fidelity has.
Yeah, interesting. Fantastic. Well, really interesting story. Alec, I suppose, is there any more we should know about this? What's, the last time you wrote about this, your your phone blew up with more tips. It's only been an hour or so since this one went up at the time of recording. Is that the case? Where do you think this goes next?
Yeah, I mean, I think there definitely is, you know, potential to dig in further to, you know, the culture, you know, in that division specifically, and why that was the case. And I think also something I'm going to try to chase down further is just, you know, how, if or how these turnovers have impacted, you know, the division's ability to serve its clients. You know, it was uncertain to me kind of at the time of reporting out this piece today, you know, if that is a problem, but, you know, certainly that's something that I'll be looking for and hoping that, you know, people turn to us with potential knowledge of.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll keep a keen eye on that. I mean, I suppose, yeah, one could argue maybe if as we understand, some people were managed out, then that could have been a deliberate decision by the company to manage people out, and maybe they felt there was a different size it was needed to be, and that doesn't impact the service, and you know, could indeed be constructive for it. We don't know that, we should say. Well, look, fascinating. Thank you very much indeed, Alec. Really interesting. Ian, that wasn't your only time to shine. You have other times to shine, including right now, as we pivot to our second story. Also a massive story this week. I guess if I'm trying to do this segue smoothly, from people leaving to people coming back. A big return this week.
Yes, I'm thinking of the gif of Abe Simpson walking in to the burlesque house in The Simpsons, taking his hat off, grabbing it, and then walking right back out the door.
Yep, and for those playing Ian Wenig Bingo at home, you've got a Simpsons reference and a slightly, but not too laboured, sort of simile analogy there. So tick off two boxes on your scorecard. What's the story?
So the story is that Elliot Weissbluth, here's my 150-cent word of the day, the erstwhile founder of Mega RA Hightower Advisors, has returned to the industry as an advisor to a private equity firm, Little John & Company, which is looking to make its first ever RA acquisition.
The wild card there, the Little John reference. No, it has to be done. Okay, so let's pretend, as I'm sure is not the case, but if one didn't know who Elliot Weissbluth was, let's give the sort of the Wikipedia entry on him before we then go on to what he might be doing.
So, I mean, a lot of the RA industry probably isn't where it is without Elliot Weissbluth, who, as mentioned earlier, founded Hightower Advisors in the late 2000s, and by recruiting advisors out of the wires, helped grow it into a business with hundreds of advisors, billions upon billions of assets. Now, to give you some context about why Elliot is no longer with Hightower Advisors, a lot of the Hightower business proposition was based on the company eventually going public. And so to recruit advisors out of the wires, Hightower would offer these advisors a combination of forgivable notes and stock options.
And in the Hightower, the
yes,
company.
Yes, that's correct. And the idea was that you could monetize those stock options during an IPO. And so what happened was the IPO never happened. The recruitment bonus lockup period, which we discussed before, those expired. The options vested. And so there was nothing keeping the advisors on the Hightower platform anymore. They became elevator assets, to use a little bit of an inside baseball term. And so what happened was in 2017, Thomas H. Lee Partners invested in Hightower and put a $100 million capital infusion into the company. That money was used primarily to retain advisors on Hightower's platform, buying them and locking them up. And then a couple of months later, Elliot stepped aside as CEO for Bob Oros, whose exit we covered a couple months ago. And then after a couple of years, Elliot stepped aside as chairman.
Yeah, I feel actually, in a way, we talk about Hightower quite often on the podcast because, as discussed, they're this sort of not quite perfect, but very interesting sort of bellwether for the evolution of the RIA industry. And sort of the evolution of that company kind of speaks to how the wider movement has evolved. And so, yeah, so to your point, sort of Elliot was a pioneer, but to some degree, the model that he pioneered also got overtaken by time or events. Or I suppose had the IPO happened, that wouldn't have been the case, but it didn't. And as such, sort of the industry moved a little bit beyond where it was, and it had to then re position itself.
Yeah, and they pivoted a couple of times, but Elliot was leading the company. So they went from that Wirehouse recruitment model to a dynasty-style platform services model, and then finally to acquiring RIAs. So Elliot, yeah, I mean, he had the vision. I mean, he is, I think, a key figure in making this industry what it is today.
Yeah, and obviously showed the ability or to adapt at least once or, or twice to where things were going. Okay, so then he left Hightower in, forgive me, which year?
So he was officially done with Hightower in any formal capacity at the end of 2020. So it's been about 5 years.
So 5 years, decent amount of time, isn't it? Okay, and so let's get on to what he's... And he didn't do anything in wealth management during that time, to the best of our knowledge.
Well, he taught at a business school in France, and he was also on the board of directors of a Canadian energy company.
Okay, cool. But yeah, not troubling our headlines an awful lot, basically.
No.
And then now he's back with the aforementioned Little John. And Little John is a private equity firm?
Yes, that's correct.
That currently does not have a major or any investment in the RIA space.
They do a lot of industrial, logistics, transportation style investment. They have some services investments, but they don't have any direct wealth management exposure to our knowledge.
And that, with their hire as an advisor of Elliot, is what they're looking to change.
Yeah, and it makes sense that if you are a private equity firm without a track record of investing in the space, well, a way in which you can build credibility is by adding a familiar face. So from a Little John perspective, I mean, it makes perfect logical sense to have someone like that involved that can help source an acquisition, help negotiate, help identify what are the traits in an RIA that would make sense as a platform investment look like.
Okay. And do we know any more? Do we know the size of the firm or type of firm they might be looking for or any sort of timeline? I mean, assuming this is obviously not a permanent position, so it's effectively to sort of help, I don't know, buy the sort of anchor investment from which you might then make further acquisitions or to sort of devise a strategy and oversee one or two deals. But yeah.
I mean, it can take time. I mean, look, there have been private equity firms that I know that had looked for multiple years before making that first investment. So I wish I can give you a more definitive or snappier answer to clip and share on social media, but
we're kind of playing... Because that's what we're all about. That's very much our style, yeah.
We're kind of playing the waiting game a little bit.
Okay, excellent. Anything else we should know about that or Elliot or Hightower before we move on to our final story?
No, I mean, I do think, though, that, again... This is the theme I talk about both on our podcast whenever someone is silly enough to invite me on as a guest, is that I think that the growth of Hightower, I mean, Elliot was this unique, charismatic force, and it was a business that was built a little bit around his personality. And now Hightower, I mean, the visual aesthetic is still unrecognizable. It's much more of an institution. And so I view Elliot's career arc as sort of a direct parallel to the rapid growth, scale, and professionalization and institutionalization of these businesses.
Really interesting. Well, look, thank you. And yeah, well, again, another story for us to keep our eyes on, and maybe another story whereby sort of getting it out there, more people get in touch. Okay, so let's come to our final story of the day of the podcast, which I suppose touches a little bit on last week's episode, which was all about our 50 Growers report. And we did talk then, I believe, about how of the 100, and I should have this number to hand, 146 of the 146 firms featured in the report, so 50 fastest growers in every state, and then in most states three or two, and in some case no runners up. That's how you get to 146. Of those firms, there were 34 that were below $1 billion in assets. And we touched on this idea that it wasn't all just the biggest, most well-known firms making up our list. And we decided to do more work on this, Alec, to sort of dig into who some of those firms were and how they got there. And I called you Alex, but your name's Alec. Please take it away.
Yeah, so we did some additional digging for throughout those 34 RIAs, a couple of them have since surpassed $1 billion in it.
Seven of them, I believe, right, in fact.
Since, the end of 2024.
A quick note on methodology for those who weren't listening last week. The way in which we arrive at our fastest growers across America is we calculate a growth score based on their percentage AUM growth. their absolute AUM growth and the increase in their employee headcount. We do this based on ADV data up to the end of 2024. Therefore, the AUM data that we're using to decide which firms have a billion or less is up to the end of 2024. Of course, we are now in August 2025, and so some of those firms' assets will have grown. Continue.
Yeah, so, you know, it was pretty interesting just to dive into the, you know, what's here across those 34 RIAs. You know, they were from 20 different states, you know, of varying sizes, you know, from Colorado and Tennessee to New Hampshire and Montana, and, you know, also varied in, you know, AUM size, you know, all the way down to $116 million in the case of, you know, a Wyoming RIA.
Gervais Capital Management of Wyoming, yeah.
Indeed, and, you know, all the way up to, you know, close to $1 billion in the case of others. So, yeah, I mean, you're sought to reach out to a couple of them and along with some experts to kind of dive into a bit more behind, you know, why they were successful in the growth.
Because this is interesting because it is very different. You know, we talk about them a lot, obviously, I think, again on the podcast, but like a Creative Planning or a Cerity Partners, as we mentioned, I think last week as well, you know, the way they're going to grow is going to be radically different. You know, if you're a national firm trying to meaningfully grow each year, you've got to add tons and tons of assets, and your strategy for doing that's going to be very different. You've got probably institutional backers who want to see a very different type of growth. But if you are at the smaller end, you're not going out and spending tons of other people's money to do this. You've got to do it in a different way. So as much as we could find commonalities, what were some of the sort of the key things you learned in speaking to some of these firms?
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, it's nothing that we don't already know. You know, I think a lot of these firms just kind of emphasize, you know, doubling down on client service and ensuring that they have, you know, a strong staff that's able to, you know, cater to these folks. You know, really, you know, knowing your audience, I think, was crucial. You know, I had a quote in here from Rob Madore, who is, you know, a M&A, you know, specialist at firm Marshberry. And, you know, he kind of summed it up by saying, you know, if you can master who your audience is, you know, more than likely you can figure out where to spend dollars and time to find more of them. And that was, I think, you know, the case across many of the firms that I spoke to, you know, in addition to obviously, you know, working with those clients and doubling down on, you know, their specialties and whatnot. You know, I think also, you know, making sure that they're in the community. You know, I spoke to a Wyoming RIA, Traction Financial Partners, that, you know, goes to, you know, local, you know, community, like stock alliances and things like that in Wyoming to, you know, just try to meet new people. So I think it's those kinds of, you know, smaller efforts just are translating.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit, you know, it's not super sexy, is it? But it's basically being out in your community, being at events, being in local sort of clubs or conferences or whatever you'd sort of call them, trying to speak at as many of those. But I mean, I guess the key thing that really came through to me in reading this piece was referrals. It's really about referrals, and my sense was that the key referrals are client referrals. So getting your existing clients to mention you to someone else. And I thought there was a really interesting point in your piece where someone said, actually, you know, it really pays off to sometimes give a lot of attention to the smaller, or I suppose lower net worth clients that you might have, because while sometimes those clients in and of themselves may not be the most lucrative, they obviously have fewer assets, if you treat them well, they can actually lead to lots of other good referrals. So I don't know, it seemed, you know, obviously it seems a bit, well, duh, to say, you know, look after your clients, be present in your community, but actually the things that drive is further referrals, and that's obviously sort of that's growth, isn't it?
Yeah, and it ingratiates yourself and kind of forms further client stickiness to an extent, you know. And, you know, one of the firms I spoke with mentioned that they kind of, you know, 75% of the time they're obviously working with folks in, you know, on a formal basis, but, you know, the other, you know, 25% of the time they're working with folks informally and just kind of seeing what they can do for them. And I think that kind of thing goes a long way.
That's interesting. Ian, any thoughts here? I've got a question for you both in a minute, but
yeah, I mean, I think what something like this says is, you know, I'm thinking about the example of the firm in Wyoming, like Attraction Financial Partners. The spheres of influence
with two mentions in this pod, they certainly are living up to their name. Yeah, yeah.
With, you know, in a community like that, where the center of influence and the absolute number of people that have wealth that qualify as a profitable RA client are so much smaller, it's your only option. Like, you're not going to be able to compete with a Mariner or a Creative Planning necessarily through these massive online referral networks. or even
this is your specialism.
Yeah, this is your specialty, is that you are on the ground, local, and you're in the community. It's old-fashioned blocking and tackling or old-fashioned retail politics.
Yeah.
You make connections in your community, and you build from there.
So then I suppose this is my question, is what comes next? And I asked this slightly through gritted teeth because nothing has to, but I suppose that's the question, is how is it possible to then scale those businesses if your focus is pretty local, if it is quite hand-to-hand combat to go out and meet these people, if you are kind of founder-led, founder-run, how do you, you've done, obviously these firms have done amazing well to grow as fast as they have this last year. Some of them might have done that before, and some of them will go on to do it again. But is there a point at which you get to a size where you sort of cap out?
So let me take a stab at this. I'll use a real life example. So my sister-in-law, my wife's sister, she lives with her husband, my brother-in-law, in a town.
Just very quickly, shout out for a new member of the Wenig family.
Steam Wenig family.
Usually the wife, recently the mom, now the sister-in-law. This is great.
Yes. So they live in near a town
called... Oh, sorry. You just corrected me on the surname. I apologize to everyone concerned. And I mean that, and I'm sorry.
They live in a town called Smithfield, North Carolina, which is kind of an exurb of Raleigh, about a 45-minute drive out. And I drive through their downtown, and there's an Edward Jones branch office. There are some financial advisors in there. Historically, Smithfield was a pretty small town, but the town has grown recently as an extended commuting option for the Raleigh area. There's a massive Amazon fulfillment facility that got built there. There's new retail getting built there all the time. And so I feel like these quote-unquote more provincial RAs, their fates, if they don't aspire to be like a Peter Malouk, their fates are tied to the communities that they live in. So if you're an RA based in a Smithfield, well, if your town's growing and there's new jobs coming in, that's new wealth being created, and that's more potential business for you. So you're kind of, talk about being in with the community, you cast your lot with the town you're in, for better or for worse.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I suppose also there are, there are neighboring towns, there's the possibility of merging, and obviously there's the possibility, as we well know, of selling to a larger firm, etc., and maybe getting more resources as a result of that, which could help you with various initiatives.
And I should also add, you kind of referenced, going toward the future of what these folks can look toward. And I think one interesting thing that I saw in the reporting was, I spoke to a firm in Delaware that I referenced earlier, Gray Fox, which is our top grower I think it was our second growing state there. But the leader of that firm mentioned to me that they recently went out and purchased a CPA firm and are looking to kind of create this entity called Gray Fox Tax Advisors, and they're also in the process of launching an investment banking division. So they're looking to kind of double down on their client base, which is a lot of small business owners, and help them through a lot of those processes. So I think it's interesting to see as well how a lot of the a lot of the mega RAs that we cover kind of are working to extend their service offerings, either through buying, CPA firms, or, just doubling down on estates and tax and things like that. And we kind of see a similar pattern in some ways taking place in a lot of these smaller firms.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, actually some of the strategies the larger firms are doing are repeatable for these smaller firms, obviously at a smaller scale. And just for the avoidance of doubt and for anyone in Delaware who's worried, the fastest grower was Rivers Edge Advisors. It's Rivers Edge. It's all one word. Rivers Edge. I don't know. You could say spell it with two words. And Gray Fox Wealth Advisors, which sounds a little bit like a sort of, I'm going to move on from that. Anyway, they came in second as the second fastest grower in that state. Excellent. Look, guys, thank you both very much indeed. I think we covered an awful lot of ground there. I suppose before we go, we have some obligatory questions to get through. Boys, how's the baseball going?
Better for me than you. Padres are in first place now.
I'm going to decline to comment on the status of the Mets. I'll be too upset to complete the podcast.
How's the wild card? Looking like a wild card this year?
Looking like maybe nothing. We'll find out. It has not been a fun August.
Yeah, it's been rough. And film reviews, very quickly. 10-second film reviews. Anything to add?
Naked Gun was quite funny. For those who listened last week, Ian recommended it, and it was good.
Excellent. Well, look, thank you both very much indeed. Ian, did you have anything else to add? Cool. Well, we'll leave it there, and we'll be back again very soon for another episode of This Week in Wealth.